Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Zappa, Stats and Enemies of Music. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I am CMU editor Andy Maltz. With me is CMU business editor Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Are you feeling confused?
I am feeling very confused.
And mildly upset. Don't worry. Everything is absolutely fine. What was once a CMU podcast is now called Setlist. We decided to have a bit of a revamp.
A rebrand.
A rebrand, a revamp. Yeah, not really a revamp. It's basically the same podcast as it was 2 months ago with a new name.
And a new logo.
And a new theme tune.
Let's not forget the new logo. Yeah, a new theme tune. If you're wondering why we've been away for such a long time, because we've been away for 2 months.
Which is a very long time.
And we didn't, when we last, well, actually, on the last edition before we broke, when we were still the CMU podcast with a capital P, whereas now we're the CMU podcast with a little p that's called Setlist. Does that make sense?
It does.
Did you get the grammar?
Yes.
We said we'd be back in September. We were vague about when in September, but we did
not vague enough.
We did talk about us being back before the Mercury Music Prize was presented.
Yeah.
And that now happened so long ago, I can't remember who won it. But let's not comment on it.
Was it?
No.
I don't know.
It's even though I got a press release quite recently telling me that whoever it was
has Sampha
sold a load more records. That's right. That's who it was. Well done for remembering that. So we were vague on when we were coming back, but we certainly didn't warn you there would be a 2 month break. But
no, we said it would be September, and it is. Well, it depends how you want to get into it. We're recording this in September. It will come out in October. So,
exactly.
I mean,
that doesn't count.
Technically, I don't think we lied.
I think we probably did. Mm. But once Andy Malt had decided during his summer break that we were going to rebrand the podcast, because we hadn't thought of that when we did the last edition of the CMU podcast with a capital P. When Andy Malt decided we were going to rebrand, we realised, well, if we're going to rebrand, we need a new theme tune. You can't rebrand and have the same theme tune. And so we're going to have a theme tune. So then we had to send Andy on a 3 week songwriting camp.
To write 9 seconds of music.
To collaborate with some other composers and musicians to come up with that theme tune that you just enjoyed, I'm sure. And obviously you'll get to hear it at various points during the podcast because it will break up the various sections.
Well, so, will it?
well, you've just said that everything's going to be the same except for the different music and the different name.
Yeah, so if it might be different versions of the music.
Different versions of the music. Did you, over the campfire at your songwriting camp, did you work on some different variations and say, oh, that can be
the remix.
That can be the bit before the in brief.
Yeah.
So, yeah, an Andy Malt original composition and not some garage band loops are what is forming the theme tune of Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, new theme tune, new artwork, new name, but same old. Poorly put together content.
Waffling about the music business. We have 2 months of music business stuff to talk about. Don't worry. We're not going to spend 10, 15, 20 minutes talking about every major music business news story there has been since July. Although, we're going to talk about one of the sort of best, funniest, quirkiest, most outrageous stories of this week. And then we are going to sort of do a little bit of a review of some of the stats that have come out.
Yeah.
And then the last bit, we are going to name check some developments that have happened in recent months.
Correct.
So we are sort of covering the 2 months, but in a sort of overview way rather than going into all the big stories in any great detail is the plan. So to talk us through in more detail what Setlist number one will consist of.
Yeah, so we're going to return to the top five enemies of music that we picked at the beginning of the year. And we're going to rate them this time. We're going to pick our public enemy number one for the music industry.
Yeah, so at the start of the year, in both CMU Trends and on the podcast, we discussed what we thought were the five main enemies of the music community in 2017. But we didn't really put them in any order.
No.
So we're going to look at what's happened since then. And on the basis of that and some very complicated maths that we've done behind the scenes, we're going to actually work out, of the five, who is enemy number one as of October 2017.
Yeah, so we're going to do one of those sort of mid-year lists that everyone does, except we were away for the middle of the year, so it's almost an end-of-year list.
We weren't away for the middle of the year, because technically that's the 1st of July.
All right.
But we were away for the school holiday, which is perhaps when people are prone to do those lists.
Yeah.
So that's at the end, in the middle.
In the middle, we'll have some of the top stats that have come out in the middle of the year lists and reports that came. Well, they were sort of, autumn reports. In the music industry's downtime in August, lots of reports get published. We're going to pull out some top stats from those.
Because everyone loves a stat.
Everyone loves a stat. But first, we're going to talk about Dweezil Zappa and whether or not he should be allowed to use his own name. Which is amazingly a thing that is an actual question.
Well, on one level, it's an amusing story. You might think it's an outrageous story. It's potentially an example of trademark law out of control.
Yeah.
So Dweezil Zappa, son of Frank Zappa.
Yeah.
Basically, Frank Zappa had four kids in total, yeah. of which Dweezil is probably the best known, mm-hmm. because obviously he's a performer in his own right.
Yes.
And there's quite a lot of squabbling going on between the various siblings
yeah.
over the Frank Zappa estate, the Frank Zappa brand, but crucially, the Frank Zappa name and the Zappa name and anything that might be stuck next to the Zappa name.
Yes, as your intro there, which did quite succinctly sum it up, but still made it sound very confusing.
Because
it is incredibly confusing and complicated, as per the insanely long statement that Dweezil Zappa put out last week, which I had to read in three sittings. It was so long. But basically, it all came off the back of an announcement that was made earlier in September, saying that basically there's a Frank Zappa hologram touring show in production, which is planned to go out on the road next year.
So that's the latest of these, let's take a dead pop star, rock star, create a hologram. Techie people might like us to point out it's not actually really a hologram. It's a technology that creates something that looks like a hologram. But we've had, obviously, we had the Tupac hologram. There was a Freddie Mercury hologram, wasn't there? So it's something that people have been talking about a bit. We think ABBA are coming back with holograms.
Yep.
Have they confirmed it's actually holograms? Are they still being a bit vague about what this new ABBA project is?
I think they said that, but they were quite vague. So they were calling it virtual reality, and I'm pretty sure it's not virtual reality.
Yeah, they mean holograms that aren't really holograms.
Yeah.
So holograms are a thing, and so the estates of various dead pop stars or outfits like ABBA who aren't dead but don't perform anymore see this as a way of putting those acts back on tour around the world. And you can look at it from one of two ways. You can either say, oh, well, that's nice because Tupac, Freddie Mercury, Frank Zappa, never going to see those guys perform live ever again. So something that's nearly like that experience. And then you have live performers on stage around the hologram, don't you? That's the clever bit. So you can have live musicians and singers seeming to collaborate with the dead musician who's there in hologram form. So you can either say, oh, that's nice. It means I can go and see Freddie Mercury perform live and that wouldn't have happened otherwise. Or you could say that's an incredibly cynical exploitation of the memory to squeeze yet more money out of a live show that isn't even really a live show.
Because the great thing about performers once they're dead is that you don't have to get their consent, which is how Audrey Hepburn ends up in adverts. Things like that. There's a film about that. What's it called? The Confluence. It's a good film. You should watch it.
I will. Anyway. So, there was this announcement last month that the latest of these hologram projects is the Frank Zappa on tour as a hologram, and the Zappa estate are endorsing this. They're involved in this. Indeed.
Ahmet Zappa, who is one of the siblings.
So Dweezil's brother.
Yes. So Ahmet and Diva Zappa operate the Frank Zappa Family Trust. And Ahmet Zappa is now actually becoming involved with this company, iLlusion, who are making the Frank Zappa hologram. He's their like, business development director now or something.
Yes, so there's a real partnership going on between the Zappa estate and this hologram live show company. And so they made this big announcement that the Frank Zappa hologram tour was coming soon. Ahmet Zappa put out a statement as part of that announcement where he was basically explaining what was going on. And then I suppose it was quite unusual for an official announcement. There was then a little bit in the middle where, actually, if you looked at what it was saying, he was sort of pondering.
Yeah.
Or imagine what we could do with this. Imagine if this happened. Imagine if that happened. And one of the things he was imagining in his pondering bit of his statement was, imagine if we had Dweezil performing with his father live on stage. But if you only gave that a cursory glance, it could have read like, that is part of what we have planned once the Frank Zappa hologram tour starts
going. Well, he actually followed it up with something more like, that's something I would like to see happen. It's definitely not a confirmation that is happening.
Correct. And if you do read the full quote in context, it was clearly a wouldn't it be nice pondering bit. But if you just gave it a very quick glance, it did sort of imply, perhaps, that Dweezil Zappa was involved in this. And anyone who is a fan of Dweezil Zappa or who follows the Zappa family saga closely, well, quite a few people on social media, as soon as that hologram announcement was put out there, were saying there is no way Dweezil will be involved in this project because the acrimony between the various siblings is quite long running.
Yes. And so this is where we get into the really complicated nuts and bolts of this story. The background of this, basically, Dweezil Zappa has been performing a show called Zappa Plays Zappa since 2006, in which he, Dweezil Zappa, plays the music of his father, Frank Zappa.
So Zappa Plays Zappa.
It sums up. It's a perfect name. Which is why, when his mother, Gail, trademarked the name shortly after he started performing under that name, he agreed to license the name back from her. And I think, I mean, he says he was charged an extortionate amount of money to use that name. However, when she died in 2015, Ahmet and Diva Zappa took over the trust, and they tried to get him to sign a new agreement with various new terms, which involved loads of things like he had to sell official Zappa merchandise at the shows, 100% of the profit going to the trust, not well, 100% of the revenues going to the trust, so he wouldn't get any money for selling that merch. And he refused. He changed the name of the show to Dweezil Zappa Plays the Music of Frank Zappa, which is still accurate but clunkier. And they said, no, you can't do that, because
they, being the trust.
The trust said, you can't do that. We own Zappa, the trademark, and you still need to agree terms to use the name. So he ended up changing the name then to Dweezil Zappa Plays Whatever the Fuck He Wants, the Cease and Desist Tour.
Which is a great name. It's quite long and clunky, but it's a great name.
Yeah.
Although it only makes sense to people who know the backstory, which his fan base definitely do. Although a Frank Zappa fan who isn't necessarily following all of this, who would like probably to go and see Dweezil Zappa play his father's music, wouldn't necessarily immediately be drawn to that show.
Yeah. Now, you might think that this all seems very petty and unnecessary, which it is. But, I mean, the Trust's argument is that Zappa Plays Zappa doesn't specifically say that it's Dweezil Zappa, and it, you know, should be the right of any member of the Zappa family to perform a show called Zappa Plays Zappa. He has pointed out that he is the only member of his family who has the musical ability to play any of his father's songs, but that is beside the point. Maybe there will be grandchildren along the way who want to play these songs.
It can be bred to be able to play their grandfather's music. Or indeed, perhaps they could create a hologram child who could play Frank Zappa's music.
Dweezil Zappa then tried to trademark his own name, because, you know, before the Trust can do it. At which point they started, I think this is a new development, that the Trust has now opposed his trademark application because they think it might create confusion in the market, because they might think Dweezil Zappa's name on things. People might think that has something to do with Frank Zappa, which, I mean, who would think that? I mean, it does create confusion. It's all very confusing. And now, so he is...
What's confusing is all these trademark battles.
Yeah.
Dweezil Zappa singing songs of Frank Zappa, that's not confusing. That somebody else in the Zappa family might also want to sing the songs of Frank Zappa, that's not confusing. What's confusing is trademark on trademark on trademark. That's when it becomes confusing. Which is sort of ironic, because one of the points of trademark, I mean, there are two sides to trademark law. Trademark law is different to, say, copyright law, even though it's another branch of intellectual property, in that... Trademark law is partly about rewarding people who invest in building a brand and their creativity. So like copyright, partly it's about allowing people to protect and reward things they create. But part of trademark law is about consumer confusion, about consumers not being, in essence, tricked into buying something, thinking that it is officially part of something else. So therefore, making things simple for consumers is part of what trademark law is trying to achieve. Although, as I say, sort of the irony here is, it's only because of trademark law this has all become so bloody confusing.
Well, the irony is that Dweezil Zappa points out in his statement, he has now, this, you know, Zappa Plays Zappa is a really well-regarded show. That's been going for a long time, and it is a way of bringing his father's music to new audiences and people, you know, and then selling records off the back of it. And so he argued that he's made a lot of money for the Zappa Family Trust with this show over the years, and then the trust go, no, you can't use that name, you're confusing people, they think it's something to do with Frank Zappa, when all it is promoting Frank Zappa very successfully. That's very just a confusing situation. I think there are a lot of things behind the scenes that just aren't, like, kind of out publicly. I don't know, there must be more bad blood than just people worrying about confusion in the market.
And we should stress that in terms of us commenting on this story, I mean, we've been aware of the acrimony for quite some time now, but in terms of all of the latest developments, what we're talking about here is the longest statement you've ever seen from Dweezil over here, and then no statement at all from the Trust over here. So we know that there are these competing registrations of the trademark registry in the US. We know there are the disputes, but I suppose we are coming at it very much from yes. Dweezil's perspective, because he has been incredibly detailed yes. and open about his perspective. And certainly when you read that massive post he put on his website, as I say, we've only got one side there, so we probably shouldn't draw conclusions without having the other side putting their arguments forward. Although if you do just read Dweezil's side of the story, you do reach the end thinking, oh, for God's sake, brothers and sisters, this guy is a great musician. He's performing your father's music. He's keeping your father's music relevant. You're already earning some money on the back of that. I mean, presumably there's songwriting royalties coming through ASCAP and BMI or whatever anyway, which I assume go to the trust.
Yeah.
So you're already earning from all of this. For God's sake, just let him get on doing what he's doing.
Well, there are various other points. There's like he on that pledge campaign, he said that they're trying to block me from using my own name and make me basically brand myself as Dweezil because I can't use Zappa. The family, Armin Zappa has said in an interview with Rolling Stone, we're not trying to do that. It's 1,000,000% false. We're not doing that. The Trust tried to get the Pledge Music campaign taken down on the grounds that they're not trying to do that. Although the wording, the statement was slightly ambiguous in that you could read it to mean they're not trying to stop him having Dweezil Zappa as his name on his gas bill. But they kind of are, if they're trying to block his trademark application on the grounds that it uses the name Zappa, they are trying to stop him using his own name.
As a performer.
Yes.
In a commercial sense. So that's a little bit ambiguous as to what's going on there. But the pledge campaign is ongoing, and yes. it's sort of coming to a head now, and Dweezil Zappa wants the trademark registry in the US to basically rule on all of this. And he reckons that's going to be at least another $30,000 in order yes. to take the next bit. I think ultimately it'll have to go to court. And so
he's going to trial, yeah, yeah.
So he needs to raise at least another $30,000. So the pledge campaign was not taken down. The pledge campaign continues.
And is now selling a range of new merchandise.
On the back of the hologram yes. story.
So you can buy No Fake Frank t-shirts and also a bundle of live album and t-shirts and stuff called the I'm Allergic to Holograms bundle. So that's fun. He also, there's another thing he pointed out in the statement is that he has to raise money to take this all to trial to get the trademarks office to rule on his trademark, whether or not he can use his own name as a performer. But he also pointed out that as a beneficiary of the Zappa Family Trust, he is also paying for the case against him.
Of course, because the Zappa Family Trust, when the money comes in, will be split across the beneficiaries yeah. of the estate, of which Dweezil is one of those yeah. people. So yes, if the estate is spending money on lawyers to try and fight all of this, technically that's money coming out of the estate, of which a chunk would be going to Dweezil Zappa. But it was interesting, obviously this has been rumbling on for some time now, but it does seem that the announcement of the hologram tour motivated Dweezil to write this incredibly long statement, also add those extra products to the pledge yeah. campaign, which I think was also partly because the announcement of the hologram tour got an awful lot of coverage.
Yeah.
So it was sort of piggybacking on the fact
and
that
a lot
was
of people reporting that he was going to be involved.
Yes, yes, having not properly read what the official statement had said. So in some ways, he sort of capitalised on the renewed interest in his father because of the hologram tour in order to make a big statement on what was going on, in order to add these extra products to his pledge campaign to try and bring in a little bit of extra money. But the Trust hasn't formally responded to Dweezil's post. So as I say, we don't have their side in terms of the active live trademark dispute, which may indeed get to court very soon. Although I think what we do have pretty damn good confirmation of out of all of this is while Frank Zappa may be going on tour as a hologram, that hologram will not be playing alongside Dweezil Zappa, or certainly not the real Dweezil Zappa.
Maybe they create a hologram of him, yeah.
I'm not quite sure what that would presumably come into personality rights or something. I don't know. But that would be an interesting extra dilemma to the case. And I suppose it was interesting in Dweezil's blog post, he was also laying into the concept of holograms going on tour. So he was very much on that. This is yes. a cynical exploitation side. Although it's interesting to know whether or not he thinks that across the board, or whether it's really just this one hologram project that he's taking umbrage to. Because he did say that he, not only is he not involved, he didn't know anything about it
yeah.
until the announcement went live. And then people were contacting him via social networks saying, oh, this implies you might be involved in this. Are you involved in this? And he was like, I've never heard of this. And then he clearly went off and spent 24 hours, presumably, on his keyboard writing that incredibly long.
It did feel that long, yeah.
Trademark law update. So we'll see where this goes as Zappa v. Zappa, the Zappa Trust won't like the court case being called that, will they? It'll have to be Zappa v. Dweezil. Otherwise, the name of the court case might be infringing their trademarks in the trademark court. But we'll
can you get a court case stopped on those grounds?
Well, it's never happened before, but that doesn't mean it couldn't happen this time. We'll see, I guess. Perhaps that's what he could call it. He could call the tour Zappa v. Zappa and just say, well, it's named after the court case and no one owns the name of a court case. That could be a solution.
Yes, maybe that was the end of a very complicated story. Maybe that is the simple solution to all of this, to just name your tour after a court case.
Yeah, thank God we're back with our solution.
Still to come on the show, we'll be running through our top five enemies of music, plus some of this week's other music business stories in brief. But now, let's get on to those summer reports that we mentioned earlier.
Yes. So as you sort of alluded to, you get halfway through the year. And so various music industry and record industry trade bodies and organisations, they either take all the stats from the first 6 months of the year and then they pump those out to us. We've talked about this before on the podcast, how it used to be that the record industry has always been quite prolific in putting out statistics about how the industry is going. To be fair, even in the 2000s when everything was going really badly.
Yeah.
But it used to be that there was an annual report and they would all come out at the start of the year and then the IFPI would put out the global report and then that would be it until next January. Whereas now they're always putting out stats. And so the half year point is an opportunity. But also there's been some consumer research about what's happening at the moment. UK Music have their annual Measuring Music report. So we've had there was a couple of weeks where it just seemed every day there was some report coming out full of statistics that you had to get your head around in order to report on. So we thought we'd just pick out some of those numbers, most of which has to be said. I'm not doing a very good job of selling this segment of the All New Setlist podcast, most of which confirm what we already knew. There were very few surprises, if any surprises, in any of the stats that have been unleashed by the various trade organisations over the summer break.
Well, let's see, shall we? Let's see. Well, you mentioned the UK Music Measuring Music Report. That's one that's generally, I mean, that does come out in the middle of the year every year, and it's generally used for sort of more lobbying purposes because it puts an economic value on the UK music business.
Yeah, so it's a report that attempts to demonstrate the contribution the wider music industry in the UK makes on the British economy and to put a figure on it.
And then to say to government, this is why you should work hard to make things easy for us because look at the money we're pumping into the economy. So Brexit is the thing at the moment. Don't make things difficult for us with Brexit. Look at the amount of money you stand to lose if the music industry collapses because of visas and problems with getting CDs across borders.
And UK Music started doing this Measuring Music report a few years ago, very much with that objective in mind. And to be fair, I mean, how reliable all these figures are, I have no idea, because it is the entire music industry. So it's not just the record industry, the recorded music industry, which is usually when you get music industry stats, it is the record industry. It's how much has come in by selling CDs and downloads and streams and a little bit of sync and public performance thrown in there. On the publishing side, we get the collecting society figures, so we know what money has gone through a PRS or an MCPS. But then the other parts of the music industry generally don't put out official figures every year. So it's always interesting to know quite how UK Music is getting those figures together. They survey lots of people, they involve all the trade bodies, etc., etc. But whatever, what I will say about this report is it has worked in that now, whenever you go to some music event in Westminster or Whitehall that has political people there, ministers or MPs or whatever, they now quote back to the music community, the music community's own figures. They will always say in their speech, there will always be the line where they will say, and of course, the British music industry contributes X to the economy. And it always amuses me that, because they're usually saying it back to the music industry and like, yeah, that's the figure. Yeah. That's the figure that we fed you.
You couldn't make up any figure.
But therefore, this report, whatever you think of it, has achieved its main aim, which it means that political people now, when they talk about UK music, as not UK Music the organisation, UK Music the industry, they do cite these figures. And most of the figures, all of the figures, most of the figures went up, they reckoned.
Yeah.
Between the 2016 edition and the 2017 edition.
Yeah, so they reckon that the UK music business contributed £4.4 billion to the UK economy in 2016, which was an increase of 6% on the previous year.
That £4.4 billion is what economists call a gross value add, or a GVA. Mm-hmm. So it's an economic figure that is used. I've never met anyone in the music industry who really understands what a GVA is.
It's not important. You just need a number.
Which is why I don't know what it is. Because everyone I've ever asked, explain to me exactly how GVA works.
No one understands what any stat really means.
People always
say... They just want a number that sounds good.
Exactly.
That's why the politicians are so happy to quote it back. I don't know what it means. I don't care. 4.4 billion just sounds good.
And people always say, oh, well, it's what the economists want. It's like, okay, if the economists want it, let's give it them. So they take that 4.4 billion and then they break it down and say, okay, this is the contribution of the recorded music bit. This is the contribution of the music publishing bit. This is the contribution of live. This is the contribution of sort of the artists and what they're bringing in and all of that. So in terms of how it breaks down...
Well, first of all, the music rights sector contributed £1.1 billion. You can break that down, £640 million from recordings and £473 million from songs.
Indeed, you'll always find that the live sector, because live's about a billion, okay?
Yeah.
And the record industry is £640 million.
Which,
and
the if live... you want to take the oh, it's all about live now, live making all the money, it's actually live making slightly less than rights.
Exactly, but because rights get broken up into the song copyright and the recording copyright, live people always like to say, oh, we're bigger than the record industry, we're a billion. And it's like, yeah, you're bigger than the record industry, but you're not bigger than the copyright bit of the music industry, as you say, because if you add £640 million and £473 million for the publishing side, it's £1.1 billion. So shut up, live people. No, don't. You're welcome to brag all you like. Although, actually, publishing saw a bigger rise than live. Live saw quite a significant rise. Of course, the record industry is back in growth.
Yep.
So after all those years of gloom, the contribution the recorded music industry makes is going up. But live grew more than recordings. But actually, publishing was slightly ahead, despite the fact that all the songwriters and publishers I meet moan about how hard things are in the streaming age. But it's like, well, your own figures show that you're growing more than everyone else. So, hey, publishers can shut up. Live people can carry on saying whatever it is they're saying.
But 1 billion plus 1 billion does not make 4.4 billion. There is still a significant chunk of money not accounted for in those stats. And that is because the single biggest contributor to the UK economy is, in fact, the music makers themselves, the artists, the musicians, the songwriters and composers, who collectively make up £2 billion of that money.
Yeah, so that's the money that the artists and songwriters themselves are bringing in. Because remember, although when you talk about the music industry, often it's tempting to say, OK, well, what's the music industry? It's the record companies, it's the music publishers, it's the promoters. But you could say, no, actually, what the music industry is all the artist businesses. OK, it's Ed Sheeran Limited and Skepta Inc., and Stormzy and Co. That's the music industry. Each artist is its own business. And then they hire the services of labels and publishers and promoters and managers. So the artists sit at the heart, and then everyone else is a service provider. And certainly these figures would suggest that it is those artist businesses that sit in the middle that do make the single biggest contribution to the UK economy from the music side of things.
Our next report is the RIAA's half-year report, which tells us how much the US record industry is bringing in. And you said everything's growing. I mean, they reckon that the US record industry is up 14.6% in the first half of this year.
And what that shows, I mean, it confirms what we already knew, but what it shows is, as we said, the 2000s was a period of decline for the record industry, the recorded music industry. 2000, 2015, it was pretty much flat. Since 2015, on the back of the streaming boom, record industry is back into growth. But what the record industry will be happiest about is the growth is escalating. So the record industry is growing faster this year than it did last year and the year before. And the vast majority of that growth is coming from the streaming services and mainly the paid-for streaming services.
Yeah, in fact, the report showed that the streaming services that are available in the US are now accounting for 62% of the total American market. And streaming revenues themselves are up 48% to $2.5 billion in the first 6 months of this year, which means we have to put our usual disclaimer on it, which is that's all great, but none of those streaming services are in profit.
Yes, so the record industry and indeed the music publishers at large are seeing phenomenal sums of money now coming in from the streaming services, mainly subscription services, although that includes the ad-funded services too, whether that be a Spotify Free or in the US, a Pandora or an iHeart, or indeed Big Bad YouTube. More on which later. But very few, if any, of those services themselves are making a profit. Most are making significant losses, which you could see as a subsidy to the music industry because that money's coming in from investors and money lenders. So yeah, as you say, we always point out it's great that things are growing, but they are growing on the back of a fragile industry.
Yeah.
People are still optimistic. We had a report come out from Goldman Sachs, the bank, over the summer, which was incredibly optimistic about potential growth in the streaming sector. I think a bit too optimistic as far as I'm concerned. But nevertheless, it was a very optimistic report. So there is some optimism that the streaming sector isn't all going to crash and burn and it go horribly, horribly wrong. It is sustainable. And so this growth the record industry is going through is sustainable. Although, at the moment, the growth is being enabled by a whole load of loss-making companies.
Now, as well as those reports, there were two reports from market research firm AudienceNet, which looked at music consumption in the US and the UK. And it looked at various things, although the most interesting thing about those was their research on how young people listen to music, 16 to 24-year-olds.
Yeah, so if we take the fact that the streaming boom is a given, obviously we would assume that those younger demographics are the most plugged in to the streaming platforms. But what this AudienceNet research was looking at is, OK, given where we now are with the streaming boom, what impact is that having on where people get their music from day to day and where they discover music? And then a few questions about what does all of this mean for good old-fashioned radio, and is that the album format is dead line that we keep hearing wheeled out? Is there any substance in that argument?
And yeah, well, what it found is actually on both sides of the Atlantic, very similar in that, yes, young people are, for the most part, getting their music from streaming services. They do still listen to radio, but not very much and much less than older generations. And also, they're less likely to listen to full albums. They're more likely to get their music from playlists.
Which is probably what you would expect, although as we found at the Great Escape this year of our Senior Insights Media Conference, whenever you sit down with a load of radio people, the official line is, it'll all be fine, it'll all be fine. But there is all this research showing that the younger demographic, I suppose, this research did show they are still listening to a bit of radio, just not as much radio as they used to. I have a suspicion quite often they're listening to radio because they're in a car or a room with an older person who's got the radio on. Are they actually going and turning the radio on? But yeah, streaming is dominating and playlists on the streaming platforms is dominating. You said there was quite a lot of parallels between US, UK. That was true. Although actually in terms of the dominance of, say, YouTube, there was a little bit of a disparity there.
Yeah, Spotify was the most listened to, or in terms of like listening hours, Spotify got the most young people listening. Whereas in the US, YouTube slightly pipped it. I think it was kind of, it was very close, but YouTube was more popular in terms of holding people's attention in the US than Spotify.
So no real surprises there in that research, or indeed the RIAA figures, or the UK music figures. And across all of them, really, optimism remains, and that has been the theme of both the record industry and the wider music industry for the last couple of years, that after that decade of doom and gloom on the recorded music side and then 5 years of not being quite sure what's happening, everyone seems very optimistic now. So I'm looking forward to the return of the exuberant over-the-top parties and events and gifts for journalists like they had in the 1990s. Hopefully that will be the outcome of the return to growth, the sustainable return to growth that maybe all of these various reports have proven. Having said that, it may well be that all of this extra cash that's coming in now is being spent on all these bloody reports, of which there is more than ever. So perhaps there won't be any extra cash for parties and free gifts for journalists. It's just all of the researchers who are doing well.
Which, yeah, given that we both started writing about the music business right as it started to collapse, seems really unfair. We want freebies.
Yes, more free nonsense press junkets promotions should be the outcome of all of this.
Quickly, time to look at a few of this week's other stories in brief. Going back to actually what we were just discussing in terms of optimism in the streaming market, Spotify has a new valuation of $16 billion, which just seems ridiculous.
That is $16 billion more than any of the profits it's ever made. So obviously, when you have a startup tech company like Spotify, it's quite hard to put a valuation on it. It's not a publicly listed company, so there aren't shares on a stock exchange where you can do the maths and work out what the market capitalization would be. But shares are being traded privately behind the scenes, and that's where this figure is coming from. These are sources This isn't an official figure. Spotify haven't commented on this, but Reuters have been speaking to various people who are seeing some of the deals being done behind the scenes and saying that they are now valuing Spotify at around about $16 billion. It was $13 billion at the start of the year. Some people are predicting that by the time Spotify finally lists on the New York Stock Exchange, it feels like that's been coming for about 90 years now, when they finally list on Wall Street, which should probably be early next year now, paperwork filed before Christmas, and then an actual listing next year, it could be as high as $20 billion. That is significantly more than revenues, let alone profit, although some people are saying that the sort of the agreed figure when it comes to valuing Netflix is to take Netflix revenues and multiply them by about 7.
Yeah.
And if you did multiply Spotify's 2016 revenues by 7, you would be above $20 billion. But valuations...
I'm not sure why you do that, though.
Well, valuations of companies like this, when there is no profit on which to base it, they're always a little bit figures out of the air. But it does come round to this whole thing that within the investment community, there is a feeling, even if people aren't buying Goldman Sachs quite incredibly optimistic viewpoint, that streaming is ultimately going to work, and that obviously Spotify, in terms of paid for streaming, is the market leader by quite some way. So streaming is going to work, it's going to be brilliant, and eventually Spotify are going to be quids in. So who knows?
Well, we'll see. The Metropolitan Police in London are reviewing their controversial Form 696, which over the years many people have accused of being used for racial profiling, an accusation that continues despite revamps of it in the past.
Yes, this was first a controversy like 10 years ago now. So it's a form that the Metropolitan Police in London and indeed some other police forces around the country have a similar form that they get people who are putting on a specific kind of event. So it's events where you have people performing to backing tracks, which already sounds like there's a hidden motive there.
Yeah.
If you're putting on those sorts of events, you have to fill out this form, provide it to the police as part of the licensing process. And some of the questions that caused controversy 10 years ago that people were saying this is so the police can spot events that are either a certain genre of music or a certain audience is likely to show up based on ethnicity, on race.
Basically asked that question, didn't who do you think is going to turn up?
Exactly.
To this?
and so there was a controversy around that, rightly so. A few questions were removed, and then it sort of went, people stopped talking about it. But more recently, people are saying this is still a problem in London. We still need to address this. The Metropolitan Police insist that these forms are not used for racial profiling and there are no problems. Although you might say they would say that. So anyway, the development is on the back of Matt Hancock, the culture minister, now digital minister, basically putting a letter to Sadiq Khan earlier this year, because obviously it falls under the Mayor of London's remit. He put out an open letter saying, we in UK government think this needs to be reviewed again. And now Sadiq has come out and said, all right, then I've sat down with all the relevant stakeholders and I am asking the Metropolitan Police to have a rethink. Of course, they may rethink, and the conclusion of the rethink is to keep it the same.
Yes.
But we'll see. And there are plenty of club promoters, artists and managers who are hoping that the elements of this that are still causing problems will be removed.
And lastly, one of my favourite, not really a music business story, it may not even be true, but it's one of my favourite stories of the week, which is that David Bowie used to hide under a table so that he didn't have to speak to Roger Moore.
So this is an anecdote that has come out because there is a biography of Bowie coming out.
Yes, and it's not an anecdote direct from Bowie. Well, obviously he's dead, but it was an anecdote that came out of an interview with someone else. It's part of this book, but it's basically that Bowie moved to Switzerland, and
this is a long time ago,
before he was dead.
A long time before he was dead, like 70s, aren't we talking about here?
Yeah, so he moved
early in his career when he was first a superstar.
Yeah,
he moved to Switzerland.
He moved to Geneva. He didn't know anyone there. But then it turned out Roger Moore lived nearby. Roger Moore came and knocked on his door one day. Presumably he was there as well and didn't really know anyone. He was like, oh, there's David Bowie. Went and knocked on his door and said, hello. David said, come in. And they sat down and they had an whole evening together where they were drinking, have dinner together. And Roger Moore was telling David Bowie lots of stories about the James Bond films that he really enjoyed. And I thought that was a great time. And then the next day, Roger Moore turned up at his door again, sat down for a drink and told exactly the same stories. And then after a few days of hearing exactly the same stories over and over again, he started hiding under a table and pretending he wasn't in. And just the imagery of David Bowie hiding under a table from Roger Moore is, I don't care if it's true or not, it's in my head now. In my head, it definitely happened and I saw it.
And so it's one of your favourite Bowie stories.
Yes.
Of all time.
Mm. You can read all of those stories in full and any of the other stories that we've discussed here today. If you go to setlistpodcast.com and you find the show notes for this show, where we'll have links for all of them. And finally this week, as promised, we're going to give you our top five enemies of music, and we're going to decide who is the biggest enemy of the music industry in October 2017.
Yeah, we're going to put them in order. So earlier this year, we published a CMU Trends article, which we also discussed on the podcast, where we reckon that the contenders for enemy number one of the music industry in 2017 were either YouTube or Spotify or Facebook or the American radio industry or, well, we said secondary ticketing at the start of the year. And secondary ticketing has remained as controversial as ever, certainly here in the UK, ever since then. Although we have seen the resurgence of Viagogo.
You think you can really whittle it down to that one?
Of being the particularly controversial secondary ticketing site. In a controversial sector, Viagogo has the king of controversy. So we're going to put it down as Viagogo specifically. So those are the five contenders. So just to wrap up this first edition of Setlist, we thought we would review what has happened with all of those five companies or sectors in recent months while we've been away. And then on the back of that, we'll try and put them in some sort of actual order.
Yeah.
So shall we talk through them in alphabetical order?
Okay, that seems like as good an order as any.
So let's start with A for American radio industry. Mm-hmm. Why are they a contender for enemy number one? Well, as we have written about in the CMU Daily on multiple occasions, yes, over the years, and I'm sure we've talked about it on the podcast as well, American radio, AM/FM radio, is unusual in that it pays no royalties to artists and record companies. It only pays royalties to songwriters and publishers. This has annoyed artists and labels, well, for at least 50 years now.
Yes, this is not a new thing.
This has been a bone of contention for a very long time. However, it's in the news because in recent years there have been proactive efforts in Washington to try and force AM and FM radio stations to start paying royalties. There's this thing called the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act that was reintroduced into Congress earlier this year. Just this last week, two more congressmen have come out as sponsors of this legislation. But behind the scenes in Washington, the lobbyists working for all the AM, FM broadcasters in America are lobbying hard to stop that from happening, still pushing out the "but think of the free promotion" argument. It's worked for 40, 50 years. Why come up with a new argument, even though that's a bit of a rubbish argument?
But if no young people listen to radio anymore, does that argument work?
Ah, well, there you go. So that continues to be a debate in Washington, and the record industry is trying to ramp it up with this new support. But behind the scenes, the broadcasters are lobbying hard. You could say that's only something that affects the American music community, except plenty of British artists have their music played on US radio.
Yeah.
And if there were royalties, those would be collected, passed back through the collective licensing system to the PPL in the UK, and then paid to artists. So actually, it isn't just affecting American artists. It's affecting any artist who has their music played on American radio. So that's why they are a contender for enemy number one.
Facebook,
they would come next. Mm. So obviously, as we all know, for a while now, Facebook has been pushing video more and more to the fore.
Yes.
They want to be a sort of YouTube-type platform while also being the social network platform that they already are. So video keeps popping up in your feed more and more. Over the summer, they launched a new tab within the app where you can go in and access the video on Facebook in more like a YouTube experience. Because obviously, people generally consume video on Facebook through their feed rather than going in and saying, "Hey, Facebook, play me this video." But they're adding that extra functionality there. A lot of those videos contain music, either because they're music videos or because they have music put in as a soundtrack, or they may be somebody doing a cover version of a song. As it currently stands, Facebook has no licenses with the music industry. So if ever there is music popping into your Facebook feed, no artist, no songwriter, no label, no publisher is earning any money. They are building this rights manager system so that the bigger labels and publishers can remove content if they don't want it to be there. And behind the scenes, they're trying to set up a monetization system like YouTube.
Yeah, and they are, there have been various staff hires that show that they are working towards getting licensing in place. And as a result, people generally now seem quite positive that Facebook is going to suddenly start paying out millions of dollars.
Yeah, even though what they're basically building is a YouTube-type system.
Yeah, so they're almost certainly going to screw everyone over.
And therefore, they're almost certainly looking for YouTube-type licenses, which we know the music industry hates. Yet, at the moment, most people, there are some people, particularly in the songwriter community in the US, who are saying, no, Facebook, they're going to screw us over. But generally, certainly in the labels and the publishers, there seems to be some optimism that they're going to get better deals out of Facebook than YouTube. I'm not convinced they will, although the rumour that was doing the rounds over the summer break was that Facebook's solution to trying to get licensing deals in place, bearing in mind they're asking for YouTube-style licenses, which they know the music industry don't like, but their solution to try and get some licenses in place quite quickly was to simply write checks for tens of millions of dollars each to the big music rights owners. And it has to be said, if you want to shut up the music industry for a couple of years, writing checks for tens of millions of dollars is a good strategy. And indeed, that's how YouTube did it. Back in the day, YouTube managed to get those early deals in place with all the music companies just by writing massive advance checks. Not quite that massive, but pretty massive. And they managed to get a few years of people being, yeah, YouTube's quite good, isn't it? And before it became, oh, YouTube's evil. So it probably is a strategy that will work.
Spotify Next, which as already established, is now propping up the entire record industry.
Yeah, so why is Spotify the saviour of the music industry on our list of potential enemies? Well, first of all, the music industry has a long history of hating the people who are helping to sell its product.
Yes.
Because back in the day, everyone hated the big record shop chains. So it's sort of predictable that this will happen. Obviously, really what we're talking about here is what's going on in the US with the whole dispute over mechanical royalties. Now, we went into all of that in great detail when we had Becky Brook on as a guest just before the summer break on the podcast. So if you want to know all that's about, go back. But huge dispute over the payment of so-called mechanical royalties by Spotify in the US, which is refusing to go away, despite Spotify previously writing checks for tens of millions of dollars to try and make it go away. But what's interesting is there was a big development over the summer break, which I'm sure we'll come back to in more detail because this is an ongoing story. Yeah. And there'll be more legal filings to come. But the most recent argument from Spotify in this dispute is we're not sure we have to pay mechanical royalties at all, which might seem like a bizarre new argument, and it is, and yes, we'll talk more about that another day. But crucially, that argument's quite controversial, and so it has the potential to annoy publishers and songwriters in America who up until this point have actually been very pro-Spotify and yeah, haven't been jumping onto this mechanical royalties dispute bandwagon. So it could be that that gets more opposition to Spotify across the American songwriting community, even with those songwriters who to date have had all their licenses sorted, are getting their royalties and ultimately are pro-streaming. So on one level, Spotify is the saviour, but in some quarters, it is also the enemy.
Viagogo. Where do you even start with Viagogo? I mean, this is the things that they've done since last time we talked about this. It's an impressive list of annoyances. They annoyed Parliament. They annoyed managers. They've annoyed promoters. They've annoyed other governments other than our own. They've annoyed their own sellers recently.
They've annoyed advertising regulators.
Yep.
They've annoyed the entirety of Australia, as far as I can see.
Yep.
Various things going on in Australia. Most importantly of all, they annoyed Ed Sheeran.
Yes.
Don't annoy Ed Sheeran.
Don't mess with Sheeran.
Obviously, secondary ticketing at large is controversial, but of all the secondary ticketing platforms, Viagogo is the one. Well, they're based in Switzerland. They don't talk to anybody. And whereas the other sites, the StubHubs and Live Nation sites, the Seatwaves and Get Me Ins, when an artist says, no touting, really no touting, usually they'll play ball and they'll try and remove it. Whereas Viagogo are just like, screw you, who cares? We're going to allow those tickets to be touted. And when people buy tickets by mistake, their customer services is basically non-existent. So yeah, a lot of rage specifically about Viagogo of late. And certainly, to the extent that I think the other secondary ticketing platforms must be quite liking all the heat Viagogo's taking this year, because it means the other sites, although that doesn't mean that the objection to secondary ticketing at large has gone away. They are sort of more in the background now, and it's Viagogo that everyone is explicitly slagging off all the time.
Yeah. And then fifth, YouTube.
Good old YouTube. Yes, we've alluded to that already on this podcast, and we've talked about it endlessly on past editions.
Yeah.
The music industry still doesn't like the money it's receiving from YouTube. It reckons that YouTube exploits the so-called safe harbours of copyright law to get utterly unfair deals out of the record companies and music publishers so that YouTube is paying much lower royalties over to the music industry than a Spotify or an Apple Music, even though in the heads of everybody at the record companies and the music publishers and the collecting societies, YouTube is a direct competitor to Spotify. Because although YouTube obviously does lots of stuff other than music, it is also a streaming music service.
Yes, and last year, YouTube hired legendary record industry executive Leo Cohen as its global head of music to try to kind of build bridges, make friends with the music industry. He's not done a very good job of that so far.
Yeah, so nearly a year after he had been appointed, they announced his appointment actually sometime before he went and worked at YouTube, but nearly a year after they announced he was going to join the company, he at one point having run the Warner Music labels, prior to that had been at Universal. In between, he'd had his own sort of management company, hadn't he? And so, yeah, last month he wrote this blog post, went out on the Google blog, basically saying, oh, I've been at YouTube for a while now. Everything's brilliant here. Hey, music industry, everything's brilliant. Have you seen all the brilliant stuff we're doing? Look at all the money we give you. Everything's brilliant. Okay, everything's settled now. We can stop arguing. That's basically the gist of the blog. And it basically prompted everybody else in the music industry to then put out their own blogs saying, well, it's good that you think things are brilliant, but it's not.
Yeah.
And then to have a big rant about how awful YouTube is and how they're screwing everyone over and that we need to get copyright law rewritten so that we can shut YouTube down.
I'm sure when he writes it, he probably thinks it's coming across. Like you said, everything's brilliant. This is so good. The things we're doing. Oh, I'm so excited. But it does tend to read more like, shut up. We give you enough. You should be happy. Like this week, Stormzy brought out a short film based on his Gang Signs and Prayer album. And for some reason, well, partly YouTube premiered this film. But it came with a statement from Leo Cohen, which basically read like, we have the ability to make or break artists, so you better shut up. It seemed entirely unnecessary for what it was announcing.
The various blog posts that were published by the various record industry trade bodies around the world responding to Leo Cohen's YouTube is great missive. Most of them did say, we like Leo Cohen, we're glad he's there, we're glad he's optimistic, but sorry, we've been through all of this before. You might think that YouTube are doing the right thing, but they've been saying that for years. We're still not convinced. We still want copyright law rewritten to basically put you guys out of business. So I don't know what he was trying to achieve by putting that blog post out there, but it just gave everybody in the music industry yet another opportunity to have a YouTube is evil rant. And as a result of that, even though that means nothing has really changed in the last 12 months, I still think that YouTube is the music industry's enemy number one. And obviously what we've got coming up in the next few months is the European Copyright Directive will continue to be discussed in Brussels. It'll go back to Parliament, it'll go to Council. So there'll be a whole months and months of debate around the safe harbour in Europe, all of which is basically, let's get copyright law rewritten to force YouTube to write us a nice big check. So I would say YouTube is enemy number one of the five. I think after that, I would probably put Viagogo second. Because it just seems to be rarely a week goes by now without some Viagogo dissing. Spotify third, even though, as I say, Spotify is also the saviour of the music industry. And actually, I think the vast majority of the music industry loves Spotify. Some people overtly, some people quietly. So the vast majority of the music industry loves Spotify. But that mechanical royalties dispute just will not go away. And it's escalating.
The argument that they don't think they need to pay mechanical royalties, whereas actually that wouldn't affect the amount of money they're putting into the industry. It just sort of changes the streams slightly, pun not intended. But still, it just makes them look bad.
So I don't think that dispute's going anywhere any soon. And obviously it's all coinciding with Spotify listing on Wall Street. So I think there's lots of more wrangling to come there. I would put American radio fourth and then Facebook fifth, because actually I think most of the music industry is having a bit of a love affair with Facebook at the moment.
Actually, I think we put Facebook top when we did this at the beginning of the year.
I still think ultimately they will end up top of this list, but it might be. Well, if they write these checks for tens of millions of dollars per major record company, they will buy themselves a few years of good grace. So it may well be what we say, 2020, when Facebook finally gets to the top.
The big Facebook crash.
Of the all-important list of the music industry's enemies number one.
But so YouTube very much sustaining its position.
Well done, YouTube.
As the worst thing in the world.
As far as the music community is concerned, we'll put an award for you in the post.
So well done, YouTube, for winning the prize of being most hated to round off this first edition of Setlist.
The Music Business Podcast from CMU.
Correct. Subscribe, rate and review this podcast wherever you found it. Basically, anywhere you can find podcasts, you can find this podcast. If you can't, then tell us and we'll put it there.
Except YouTube. We're still not on YouTube.
Yeah, maybe we should sort that out. Don't ask us to put it on YouTube.
Enemy number one, remember.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. We're Setlist Pod on both of those.
This podcast now has its own social media presence, is what you were revealing there in a very subtle, blasé sort of way. So you may already follow CMU on Twitter and Facebook, but if you want updates on the podcast, then you need to go to facebook.com/SetlistPod or twitter.com/SetlistPod. And we will entertain you there with our pithy, amusing, informative, analytical updates on the Setlist podcast. I don't know. Andy's in charge of the social networks.
Anyway, Setlist is presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cooks, produced by Matt Peaty. For more on CMU, which presents this podcast, you can go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.